Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Rachel Ann Warren.
When someone comes to see me, I don't pretend that they don't have a problem. I don't pretend that it's no big deal, I didn't notice. I tell them, I see your problem. I have the same problem.
That and more. But first, come to the Risk Live Show in New York City on December 11th. The theme that night is collateral damage. So if you have a five-minute story you might want to share about that, you might get picked to share on stage. Plus, there will be our usual curated stories coached by our staff. And our fabulous host, J.C. Cassis, will be doing the ringleading that night at Caveat on the Lower East Side. That's December 11th. And the tickets are at risk-show.com/live.
We'll be right back.
This festive season at McDonald's, get
rich deals every day.
Okay, okay.
With a sausage sandwich for just...
Let's see, 99 MP.
Six chicken McNuggets for just...
99 MP.
Fine. Get Grinch deals every day
in the McDonald's app.
18 plus app only. Ends 24th of December. One use per offer. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. T's and C's apply.
Now here's the show. Folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and we're calling this week's episode Not in Hiding Anymore. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Rachel Ann Warren, but before that, something really unusual, something we have literally never done before. As you probably know, I've been teaching these online storytelling workshops this year, and they've become so popular. I'm so thrilled about it. They've really made us begin to feel like the future of Risk will depend on getting the listeners, you, even more engaged and involved with us to make the Risk community a more active and connected one. We've found that when you fill a storytelling workshop or a storytelling social event with Risk listeners, you're automatically bringing together compassionate, thoughtful, creative, interesting people. We've had an amazingly wide range of people from all sorts of fascinating backgrounds. Some of these folks have been reading and writing or performing or making art of one kind or another their whole lives. But others are so brand new to all of this that they show up the first week really scared. We've had people start the course who were shaking or a little teary or just really like clammed up. And then it is such a joy, it is such a miracle to watch them become more and more and more comfortable and safe and to be able to share on a level similar to what you're about to hear this first storyteller on the episode today. You know, if you're afraid that you might be too new, if you're afraid you might be the only person of your race or gender identity or socioeconomic background in the workshop, that's something we can talk about. If you want to tell a story about something you're worried folks might not understand, we can talk about that. We're creating this especially supportive and caring, positive place where people can improvise, people can share a lot or just a little. People can tell any kind of story. You know, even if you're not quite sure something is by definition a story, you can share it. So later in the episode, I'm going to let you know about the next one I'm going to be teaching very soon. But the reason I said what you're about to hear is so special is that this recording you're about to hear comes from one of the online workshop Zoom sessions. Now, that means the audio quality will not be great because it's Zoom. And please know, we don't record the online workshop sessions with the intention of sharing the recordings anywhere. Only the participants in the workshops have access to the recordings. In this particular instance, I asked this student, Mira Rivera, for her permission to run this recording from the Zoom workshop session on the episode. I thought it would be really interesting to give you a sense of the vibe, what it feels like in the workshops. I just felt it's such a wonderful example of someone opening up in a way that they weren't sure they could at the beginning of the workshop. And we were all so thrilled about it in the Zoom session, even though you can't hear the rest of us, everyone else is muted. But I feel like you will catch the vibe of how she felt she could get to this place to share in this way because of the momentum of the supportive nature of the workshop and all. So if you're thinking, I wonder if I could get over my shyness and share intimate stuff in that class, just listen to how far Mira came with that. We have her permission to share the recording with all of us now. So here is Mira Rivera in one of my online storytelling workshops with a story we call Sexual Healing.
I'm sitting in a Denny's, and this is a diner that smells like the color yellow. And across from me is the man that I've been separated from for the last 3 weeks, my husband of 10 years, who now feels like a stranger to me because he's telling me that he wants a divorce because he's no longer attracted to me. And those words replayed in my head for a minute as we were in that moment. I'm not attracted to you. I'm not attracted to you. And it just like hit me because honestly, like the year I had had prior to that, you know, I had a miscarriage. I'd had some fertility challenges. My OBGYN pointed to my womb and one doctor's appointment was like, it's just a mess in there. And so like, I wasn't attracted to me either. I probably wasn't a lot of fun to be around. And I left that Denny's just feeling gut punched and hoping, you know, perhaps there could be a sign of some sort that I could be desirable. Because when somebody, you know, tells you that, it's really hurtful. And I went along my way trying to sort of start over again, you know, all the things that one does when they end a marriage, you know, the moving and the finding a new place and the going to IKEA and getting furniture and just all the starting over. And the holidays were particularly challenging, but something I found some entertainment in was the novelty of dating apps, because the last time I had been single, I was in my 20s before dating apps. So, you know, there was still this like convenience of like, okay, even if I'm not these people's type, like I can just swipe right and left and say they are my type and, you know, come what will about what happens. And I sort of did that to entertain myself and get me through the holidays. And every now and then there'd be like a temporary ego boost, but most of the time it was short-lived and I was still really grieving through other transitions in my life. So I had changed jobs and other things. And so by the time we get to like February, you know, Valentine's Day is coming up and like I'm in the place where, you know, Valentine's Day when you're in a happy couple is like a beautiful holiday because, you know, love is everywhere. But when you're upset and not attracted to yourself, it's very different. And so I had taken some time off between the job transitions I was having, and it's a random Monday morning and I'm finding myself, you know, swiping back and forth on one of the dating apps while I'm having coffee. And I come across this photo of this like very handsome, shirtless, smiling man. And I swipe right. And like all the things I saw about him, you know, they all put their height and their weight and their ethnicity. And so I'm like, okay, like you're in your 30s and you're Puerto Rican and you're allegedly 5'11", but you know, you might be 5'5" because they lie about that. So I thought, okay, this man's way too good looking for me, but I'm going to go for it because, you know, who cares? It's entertainment. And lo and behold, like we match. And I'm just like, oh, you swipe back on me too. And that was already an ego boost. Like, I didn't even have to talk to him after that. It was just like, okay, cool. So then I message him with the opening line that I was using on every dating app. Like, you have to find something that's like still you, but like can still tell you something about a person. So my go-to opening line on the apps was, are you more likely to get into a pillow fight or a food fight? That could tell you a lot about a person. And the message pings and he replies back like within 2 minutes of me sending this. And he says, pillow fight, I don't like to waste food. And what are you up to? And so then, you know, we're making small talk on the app and he says, okay, I'm visiting LA. I'm here from New York for the week. And, you know, I just landed this morning. You know, what are you doing today? And what do you recommend I do while I'm here? And I'm like, okay, like, this is interesting. And so I recommend like the quintessential LA activity, which is like, oh, go on a hike. Like there's lots of places to go and you see like lots of good looking fit people, all that fun stuff. And then like, I wasn't planning to do this, but I just said, oh, like, I'm going to go on one later today. Like, if you want to join me. And, you know, I had no intention of actually going on this hike, but he's like, okay, great. Where do I meet you? And, you know, this all seemed like a trap or like a little too fast, but I'm like a hot New Yorker here for the week, like expiration dating. Like, that's a good entertaining thing to do. Like, I know he's leaving. That's fun. And so we arranged for me to pick him up at the metro and it felt risky, but like equally risky for both of us. Cause I'm like, yes, I'm letting a stranger into my car, but this stranger is getting into my car and letting me take him up into the mountains and I'm the local and he's not. So maybe this is more dangerous for him than it is for me. And so we're driving to the hiking spot and, you know, it's awkward and quiet because, you know, we're still figuring out each other's energy. And there was, he was just like answering in a lot of like short one word sentences. So I'm like, hey, like, what are you doing in LA? And he's like visiting a friend. And then I said, okay, well, when do you leave? Next Tuesday. And like everything was just like two word, like short sentences. And I think, okay, like maybe he's nervous. I don't know what's going on, but we go on the hike and while we're on the hike, I'm nervous. So the other thing that was sort of helping me grieve and maybe numb a little bit through my post-divorce was a marijuana vape pen. So I'm like, pull out the vape pen because I'm like, hey, you know, a little marijuana, a little nature, sun, whatever. So, you know, I'm using the vape pen. I offer him some and he says like, no, thanks. And so we keep walking and talking and it's still this like short, like just socially awkward kind of like, why are you in my brain? I'm like, why are you here? Like, you don't even really seem like you want to talk to me, but you know, maybe it's just something to do. I don't know. And so then I got nervous again and I pulled out the vape pen again and then, you know, offered it to him again because I'm, you know, not used to not offering people. Like if I have water, if I have a snack, like I'm offering a person every time, even if they say no, because they might want it the next time and I don't want to be rude. And he's like, if I want some, I'll ask you. You can put it away. And I'm like, okay. And so I just put it away and we keep going and we get to a bench and it's like this very nice quiet bench. There are some people sitting there, but like we sit down on the bench and we're like admiring the view and there's like coyotes and, you know, they're playing in the grass and it's just like this very nice scenic situation. There's some other people sitting there and they get up and like leave. And then maybe 2 seconds after they get up and leave, he scooches over to me and he like puts his arm around me and kisses me. And then he says like, I'm having a nice time. Like, thank you for inviting me. And I'm just like, well, you could have fooled me. Like, you're not elaborating. Like, you're not saying shit. Like, what is this? And so, you know, we went to coffee after the hike. You know, conversation was still this very, like, measured, short stuff. And I had to go on a work trip the next day for my new job. And so he's like, you know, maybe I can see you when you get back. And so I said, fine, you know. And so for the couple days that I was out of town, we were sort of messaging back and forth. And, you know, it was consistent conversation, but it wasn't that deep. It was just like, what should I do while I'm in LA? And, you know, where are you? Send me a picture. Like, just nothing really, like, deep or of substance. And then the night I get back into town, you know, I pick him up and we go to dinner. And after dinner, we go have drinks. So I take him to this place that has burritos. And I was like teaching him about like LA burrito culture, which is like, you know, in other places, burritos are different sizes, right? But in LA, like you could get a burrito wet or dry. And, you know, that's like part of the experience. Like if you want a knife and fork situation and you want to like be primal and eat it with your hands. And so, you know, that I kind of just said, okay, like I'm his tour guide. Like this is just what's happening. But again, I'm being entertained. This is something to do. We go to drinks after dinner. And while we're at the bar, like things are crowded and he's like starting to graze me a little bit. And he's like puts his hand on the small of my back while we're moving through the crowd. And I'm like, okay, like, I don't know, he's warming up or whatever. And I didn't think anything was going to happen. Like after we have the drinks, I'm like, okay, well, like, I'm going to go home now, you know? And he's like, great, where's home? I'll come. And I'm like, okay, like home is 2 blocks away. And he's like, great, let's go. At that point, I had a purple bong and I pasted the eyes on him and I named him Grimace because I'm like, I need company. I live alone. So I'm like, you can meet my bong Grimace. And he's like, yeah, I'd love to meet Grimace. So once we get to my place, I grabbed some drinks and it was almost as if like as soon as I closed the door to my apartment, like the awkwardness evaporated and like we sat on the couch and he's like relaxed and, you know, he moved closer to me and he's like putting his arms around me and he like smelled my hair and was like complimenting my decor. And he points at Grimace. He's like, oh, this is Grimace. And I'm just like, where is this personality coming from? Because you've been like short this entire time. And I'm like, yeah. And I pick it up and I'm like showing it to him like I'm an excited little five-year-old with my imaginary friend. He's like, awesome. He's like, light it up. Let's go. And I'm like, okay, great. So light up and like maybe two bong hits into the situation. We start like making out and eventually we like clumsily make our way over to my bed and like everything that he didn't have in conversation, like he made up for in physical chemistry because he was just like handsy and touchy and he couldn't stop kissing me. And then at one point we got to the edge of my bed and he like grabbed me by the shoulders and he's just like, just so you know, I like doing all the work and you're going to come, I promise. And then he like pushed me on my bed and like off we went. And I just was like, all right, like I'm going to just go with this. And, you know, things were going and I handed him a condom from my bedside table. He put it on sort of clumsily and he was pretty well endowed. So like watching him put on this regular size condom was like watching an elephant try to put on skinny jeans. Like it just looked like really cumbersome and like tight and he looked uncomfortable. And then he's like, hey, you know, like I brought my own. They're in my jacket pocket that's hanging on your door. And like they're over there and I didn't want to assume. So like I wanted to wait until like I knew. So can I go get them? And I'm like, sure. So, you know, he goes and gets them and he lives up to the promise of doing all of the work. And he just is complimenting my body and how I smelled. And he was like, oh my gosh, like I love your thighs. And like, I love a meaty woman. And like night and day compared to like this awkward hike we went on. And like never in my life, like I'm a plus size woman and my ex-husband and I, like sex maybe lasted, I don't know, 10 minutes tops, right? Like I wasn't used to it being longer than that or there being more. And for such a long time in the end of our marriage, like we were having sex for the purpose of reproduction. So like it also wasn't that sensual or interesting or magical or anything. And so like just never in my life had a man like picked me up and like thrown me around everywhere. And like I was just so surprised. And most of all, I was worried about my IKEA bed frame because I'm like, this thing is fighting for its life. Like I put it together with like crazy glue and an Allen wrench. Like, I don't know if it's going to last all this like throwing and things like that. But midway through, I also was like, I'm just going to be myself. And like, I lost complete control of the things I was saying. And so at one point I was like, oh my God, it's like you're fracking my vagina. Like, what is happening? And then that sent us both into hysterics. Because then at that point, we just started like using, you know, just equal parts satire and language about like climate change and fracking and like hurricanes and earthquakes. And we were just like saying all this stuff that like doesn't sound like dirty talk at all, but kind of is. And it's just kind of working for everybody. And he's like, oh my God, I'm going to thrash your coastline. And I'm like, yeah, you're ruining my whole ecosystem. And it was absurd. But the stamina on him was just unreal. Like he finished and then like maybe need 5 minutes to recover in a water break. And then he was like right back at it again. And I just like, I couldn't keep up. But over the course of the night, he just would like take the condoms and like put them on the wrapper, like the black and gold Magnum wrapper, and then like turn them into like this little flower. And then just have like this line of like little flower condoms all across my dresser. And like in between the romps and the breaks, like he started to open up to me about his family and his life in New York and his love of witchy things. And he told me he read tarot and that he was a musician and that he was OCD. And so then I'm like, okay, that explains like the little line of the flowers and like how you're sort of going through this like ritualistic thing. Anyway, we spent 18 hours together and, you know, in the course of the 18 hours, he gave me like maybe 10 orgasms, like one after another, like just when I thought I was like, all right, I'm finally going to roll over, go to sleep. Like he was like, nope, let's try it this way and let's try it that way. And I swear, like I thought to myself, like this man is giving me every orgasm I never got in my marriage. And I'm also getting like retroactive orgasmic back pay for like all the women in my lineage, like ancestrally that ever had to fake it. And I had no idea that my body was capable of that. And so then like by the end, he's like, how are you feeling? And I said, call FEMA. There's been a flood. Like, this is a disaster. And I'm thinking I'm never going to see him again. So, you know, the next morning he leaves and I spent like the next several hours just trying to nap and recover. But I felt lighter and like something had just like left me that was heavy. And Then I get a text message from him and he's like, hey, I had a really good time. I think it would be a crime not to do that again. You know, can I see you one more time before I leave town? And so I said, sure. And then he replied and he's like, I hope you have flood insurance. And I said, great. Like, I hope you have earthquake insurance. Cause we were sort of going back and forth in this like East Coast, West Coast rivalry of like, what's easier to deal with, a hurricane or an earthquake? And I said, yeah, but also like, be prepared. Cause like earthquakes, I think, are worse. And he's like, no, no. He's like, you don't understand. Like, I'm going to go. And he's Puerto Rican. And at this time, like Hurricane Maria had just happened. So he's like, I'm going to go Hurricane Maria on you. And he's like, I need you to understand, like, my dick is like the Virgin Mary statue that stays standing after the storm. Like, I'm going to just let you have this all. And, you know, so he comes back and we do it again. And it's equally fun again. And I feel like all the retroactive, you know, intergenerational orgasmic payback again. And this ends up turning into like a 2-year affair where we just fly back and forth, like seeing each other in different cities. And we sort of would pick these Airbnbs and we would just kind of like play house and pretend to be boyfriend and girlfriend for like the weekend or the few days that we were visiting and have this, you know, amazing physical chemistry together. And at this point, I would get these like really intense downloads of like stuff I needed to write down after things would happen, sometimes during the stuff that was happening. And he'd be like, yeah, you can type on your laptop and I'll keep going. Like, it doesn't bother me. And so I was just like, you know, fine. And we were just in this like fun, like creative cohabitation. And then after we would be done, he would, you know, like tell me about music he was working on and he would read my tarot cards and we would just have this like interesting, kind of awkward, but kind of fun time together. And I think I wasn't ready for something more serious when I'm still sort of figuring out, like, who am I? What is my life now? And what does that mean? But at least in this moment and with this person, I was able to really get all the grief I was holding out of me through like a creative outlet, but also through this like physical healing of sorts. And so like, he really helped me grieve sort of what I had lost. He helped me kind of make peace with my body that I was angry at. And not because like he found me desirable, but because like I could feel what it's supposed to feel like to feel my own sense of being desirable. And looking back, I think it's proof that sometimes healing doesn't come from therapy or from having like a closure talk. Sometimes it's just like you're writing some stuff down in an Airbnb and your legs are still shaking and you're relaxed, but you're lighter.
We'll be right back.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy, customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
What's up, world? It's Von Miller, Super Bowl MVP, chicken farmer, and now host of Free Range. This is a show where I go off the field and off the script. We're talking what's hot in music, film, trending news, and everything blowing up your feed. If you love football, you'll feel at home. But if you're here for the vibes, the internet deep dives, the conversation, this is your podcast. Join me every Wednesday. Follow and listen to Free Range with me, Von Miller, everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is Risk. This is Ran Reighton behind me now, and we just heard from Mira Rivera that story she shared in one of my online storytelling workshops, the recording coming to us straight from Zoom. She expressed amazement that she had gotten to a place of being able to share that one that way, and we're so grateful for her permission to allow us to run that story for all of us to hear on the episode today. Now, here's what I'm thinking the timing could be for the next online storytelling workshop. It would start on the 14th of January. We'd meet for 8 weeks doing Zoom sessions on Wednesday nights at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The sessions are 2.5 hours with a 10-minute break in the middle. For folks on the West Coast in the States, that would be 5:30 p.m. on Wednesdays. So it's probably most ideal for folks in the Central or Mountain time zones. Email me for more information at kevin@risk-show.com, and maybe you can be in our next workshop. And remember, I also do one-on-one workshopping and coaching with people. I love working that way on stories also. So just reach out and I'll answer any of your questions at kevin@risk-show.com. Now, what if you're thinking, well, I don't want to take a workshop, but I do want to be able to continue to listen to new episodes of Risk? Well, there's another way to get involved and to make sure that that remains possible, by becoming a member at patreon.com/risk. We need your support more than ever before this year. And we feel like what we do is more important than ever these days. Listen, you can also give a membership to our Patreon to someone as a gift if you go to patreon.com/risk/gift. So they'll have access to all the bonus stories and the check-ins and the ad-free feed if they don't like listening to ads, and some of our What's Your Story social events are going to start happening there too. I'll definitely be doing another check-in about how things are going for me in Bangkok so far again. So, you can become a member, you can buy a membership for someone else as a gift, you could increase the amount of your donation over there, or if you want to make a one-time donation, that's at paypal.me/riskshow. Next, we're going to hear from Rachel and Warren. Now, Rachel first appeared on the podcast in 2018. And I remember saying, oh my gosh, we have to have her on again, ASAP. Well, it's been too long, but it was worth the wait. You can find her at Rachel Ann Warren on Instagram. And here she is now with a story we call Stranded.
He was standing across from me, putting his things into his bag and getting ready to leave me for the millionth time. And I just happened to catch a glimpse of myself in the mirror. And I saw that my headband had scooted back like an inch at most. And without thinking or playing it cool like I'd always done to try to get him to stay, I just blurted out, "It's because of my hair, isn't it? The reason you're leaving me is because of my hair." And he looked up at me with shock, not because I was finally standing up to him, but because I was actually talking about my hair. My hair had been falling out for years at that point. It just wasn't something I ever wanted to confront. Looking back at pictures, I see I was probably 19 when the most of it fell out at once. I was a waitress and in college and going through a pretty major existential breakdown crisis, and my hands were erupting in this horrible eczema, and I was a waitress at a fancy restaurant. I was a singing waitress, and I couldn't open nice bottles of wine with bloody hands. So I was dealing with the emergency. I wasn't thinking about my hair. I also wasn't thinking about why I was imploding. My whole life, I had waited for this moment. I wrote in my journal and wrote on my walls, and I said, when I turn 18, my life will finally be up to me. I can make the decisions, I can call the shots, and I won't have to be miserable anymore. Up until that point, it was just a series of losses. We lost my father to mental illness and his violence, and ultimately to jail, followed by my brother, who was 2 years younger and suddenly got so sick and died, basically in our arms in our house. And then my sisters and my mom, and we lost each other to grief and sadness, and we never got back. So I went within myself, in my journal, and I prayed that the day I turned 18, the day I graduated from high school, I could finally be free. And when life doesn't turn out that way, because it's not like that, you don't get freedom and then it's beautiful and sunsets and bunnies and handholding. I felt crushed. So many hopes and dreams vanished. I had no sense of myself, so losing my hair or my hands erupting in eczema just wasn't that important. I was so outside of myself. And this began years of losing myself. I wound up with a guy who treated me like crap and called me a loser and told me how many beautiful young girls he could be with. I noticed my hair loss first. A few years before I met him, I was singing in this cabaret punk band, and we'd done some basement shows, and I always wore blue jeans and a black tank top and no makeup, no frills, no fuss. And I sang soul. It was raw, and it was just emotions. And then we had our first big show, and there was a professional photographer. So I teased my hair into this big bouffant, and I used like a can of hairspray, and I put a little black eyeliner on. But when the photos were in the paper a few days later, I was mortified. I could see right through that mirage of little wispy Charlie Brown Christmas tree hair to my shiny, bald scalp. And I was mortified. I didn't want to talk to my bandmates about it. I didn't want to talk to anybody about it. I just wanted it to go away. And I thought, well, I can never sing on stage again. But then I thought, as I had done my whole life, I have a problem. How do I fix it? And I remembered there was this vintage shop, sort of a hole in the wall in Mount Vernon on Charles Street. And the very next day, before they even opened, I was parked outside and waited for the girl to open the door. And I went straight in and made a beeline for this box I had seen once while I was trying something on. By the changing room, there was this kind of crumpled cardboard box without a sign on it, no price tags. And inside were all these beautiful, colorful drag queen wigs. And I picked out this baby blue bob. I didn't even try it on. I just paid for it, no explanation, took it home, and privately, quietly put it on. And I felt like myself, but better. I knew instantly that this was going to be me. So for the next couple shows, I wore this blue bob wig with my plain clothes. And I started adding a little more makeup. And then I realized the wig doesn't quite make sense without the outfit. So I started thrifting and I found these gowns and I started tearing them apart and putting them back together with duct tape and hand sewing and 1,000 buttons and rhinestones and LED lights and garbage bags, whatever it took to create this distraction, this persona. And my bandmates joined in and that's what I became known for. Every article, every post was about the costumes and the cabaret. But I still had to live my life. I still had to go to the dentist and the grocery store and have a job. And I couldn't do that in the day. So after every show, I'd come home and I'd undress, take my wig off, take the makeup off, the lashes, and I'd be left with myself. A self that I couldn't bear to look at. And to cope with that, I drank. Fortunately, I had a job that made everything better. I worked for a brewery, and two things. The first is I worked with all raging alcoholic men. So my drinking paled in comparison to anything they had going on. And the second was with a brewery. It's casual enough. I could wear a hat to anything and everything. One day we had a team building exercise at Camden Yards, and everyone had come up from all over the country, and we were hosting it here in Baltimore. And it was on the field with the players. It wasn't a game, but they had all the lights on, and it was during the day. And I just, not in a million years would I have expected them to play the Star Spangled Banner. But as soon as I heard the note, everyone's hats came off, and I panicked. There was no way I could take my hat off in front of these people. So I looked for an open door from the field, and I bolted. I remember passing the locker rooms and the offices, a janitor, and I just kept running and running and running until I couldn't run anymore. And it seemed like enough time had passed for the song to be over, but I hadn't thought about what I would do next. How could I possibly re-enter the field and explain myself? So I prayed no one would ask. I got some looks, but they didn't ask. And I started noticing in life that was the thing. I'd date guys. They would look, but they wouldn't ask. Or maybe they'd talk about it to somebody else who would talk about it to me eventually. Around this time, I started singing for money. And I got in with this band that played for the wealthiest of the wealthy within the tri-state area. We played at the nicest places. I certainly couldn't wear a hat, but I also couldn't wear a costume wig. So I found myself using a whole can of colored hairspray, a fake bun, a headband, and still, I remember one bandmate, anytime he talked to me, he would look straight at the top of my head. And I felt about 2 inches tall. And so to get through all this, I would drink and drink and drink. And come morning, I would panic, drink and panic and drink and panic until I couldn't even leave my house to go to the grocery store. I remember getting stuck at a red light for 2 seconds and feeling like I was going to explode or implode, or a spaceship was going to come down and scoop me up. I felt so outside of myself. So I knew that day that if I couldn't go buy cat food, something had to change. Something had to give. So that night, I decided no more drinking. And I hadn't meant to, but apparently that also meant that I would confront myself, because I sat at home, and almost as an order of business that was unknown to myself, I took my hat off in front of a mirror in my artist loft on the 5th floor in broad daylight. And I sat with myself, and I had to decide that I was worth it. Worth what? I don't know, but I had to be worth something. And I knew that my hair wasn't going to change. It wasn't going to get better. But I had to get past this thing that was eating me alive. So I started looking around me, and I saw all these costume wigs, and they're big and colorful and fun, but they're not natural. But I can sew, so I started taking my seam ripper and I started taking little bits out here and there, making them thinner and smaller and trying them on my head. And I butchered them so bad I looked like a broken doll that a dog got a hold of. And I thought, I just have to break it down more. And if I can get down to the very pieces that put it together, I saw on the floor wefts of hair, and I saw threads, and I saw elastic, and then I picked up just a hair, and it was this tiny little thing that had caused me so much grief. And I thought, if I could just put this one thing back where it belongs, then I wouldn't have to worry so much and feel so alone. So I got on Google, and YouTube and Instagram, and my whole life had been about how can I make this work? How can I make this happen? And I started researching, and I found something called a wig maker. And I knew immediately that that's what I want to be. That's what I'm going to be. During all this time and research and playing around with everything, I was also embarking on dating. for the first time as a sober person. And I met this guy who broke all my rules. He lived an hour from Baltimore in the mountains, and he had two sons. And he lived in this suburban place with a man-made lake and cookie-cutter houses. And he had this normal life and this normal job. And I gave it a shot anyway. On our second or third date, we took his pity, Mabel, out for a walk, and I put a little pink tutu on her. And I was just so happy. And he suddenly reached up for me, for my head. And I remember jolting back as though he were like coming to attack me, and I felt like I needed to protect myself. But he said, "Your headband moved back. Do you want me to fix it?" I was embarrassed and mortified. But I also felt like he could see me. And despite all that, he still cared about me. And so this wig making that had become my new secret, it had been drinking, it became wig making, was suddenly something I could share. I learned as much as I could online, and then I asked around, and through the brewery job, a bartender knew a bartender, knew a person, knew Michael, this German guy who's a master wig maker, and he's from Germany, but he lived in Nashville, and he said, sure. So every Sunday we'd meet for a couple hours, and he'd teach me how to tie the knot, how to make the wig, and during the week between gigs, I'd spend 10 to 50 hours working on wigs, building a wig, one hair at a time, one piece at a time. The whole while thinking about everything I had lost and how I was finally putting it back together. And it wasn't some imaginary thing. I was looking at it. I was building something for myself. And I knew, even before I finished that first piece, that I would be able to help other people too. Before long, I was making wigs for theaters and films in the area and women. I helped a local wig shop doing repairs and consultations, and eventually, 4 years ago, I opened my own wig shop. And over these years, I've helped hundreds, thousands of people of all ages, all stages of life. Some are at the very beginning, and some are at the very end. One woman came to me and she said, "I need a wig for my funeral." And I laughed and I had no idea what she was talking about. But she said, I'm dying. I'm going to die soon. And I've always had this beautiful, fluffy white hair. I've been in parades. People know me for this hair. But my grandkids said, Grandma, please do one round of chemo, and it took my hair, and now I'm yellowish green. I have no hair, and I look like the Wicked Witch of the West. And she didn't want to leave her house anymore. But everything we tried on was so big and clownish and thick, and she was so tiny. And so I said, I can do this. I can help you. And I pulled all-nighters, making her this wig and knotting the little white hairs into this almost invisible lace. When she came in to try it on, she got really close to the mirror and she poked her head. And she said, I have my hair back. And her granddaughter told me that instead of hiding out and refusing to see anyone, she spent the last few months of her life with friends and family. And she got her funeral hair. So when someone comes to see me, I don't pretend that they don't have a problem. I don't pretend that it's no big deal, I didn't notice. I tell them, I see your problem. I have the same problem. I've worked really hard to figure out how to fix it. And I want to help you. Thank you.
This is Risk. Now, before I say anything else, I want to remind you to go to risk-show.com/live to get your tickets to our live show at Caveat in New York City on December 11th, because nothing compares to seeing Risk live, to being there in the room. And we just heard from Rachel Ann Warren. Now, Rachel wrote to us to say this: thank you to Hope, John, David, and Kevin for putting this together. It is a therapeutic and creative exercise, and I know from the last story I told on the show, these stories can really help people feel less alone, this storyteller included. Thank you so much, Rachel. So this is the third time this week that I'm grateful that someone has come down the pike in our community to share a story about a subject matter I'd never heard anyone share about before. The first two instances were in my last online storytelling workshop session from this past weekend. It's always confusing when you're hearing this. Anyway, now there's this story from Rachel, and I'm so honored that after doing this show for 16 years, we're over 16 years now, we still have people coming to us to share about intimate or sensitive issues in their lives that we've yet to hear anyone share about on the show or in our workshop so far. It's truly something special, and I am sure that Rachel's story will help some people out there feel less alone. Be sure and look up Rachel's wig company on Instagram at Frederick Wig Company. And folks, if you don't follow me on Instagram or TikTok, please do. I'm doing more updates about how I'm doing in Bangkok now, you know, little video updates. And for all of that stuff, I'm at the Kevin Allison. I took the biggest risk of my life by moving to Thailand, and now I'm considering taking another big risk, and I'll probably be talking about some of that on social media and on our Patreon, so stay tuned. And folks, today's the day. You take a risk.